Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit michters.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
I'm Julia Tertian, host of Radio Cherry Bomb. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and today we have a special guest, a friend, Grant Reynolds. He is the wine director over at the critically acclaimed Charlie Bird, one of the real wine destinations in New York City. It's a great small restaurant in kind of the Soho meets Greenwich Village meets West Village area.
Exactly.
With just an outstanding wine program, absolutely delicious food, and Grant running the show over there. So Grant, thanks for being on this show.
Thanks for having me, Joe. It's good to be out here.
Welcome, buddy. And you know, we like to start the show with the best wine that we've had all week. I will get started, and I'll give you a little second to think about it. You know, I've had a few interesting wines. It's been a week of trying all sorts of kind of off the beaten path, unique wines. Last night I had Gamay Noir from Michigan, grape from the Madrid area in Spain, which is kind of an up and coming area. But really, kind of the most compelling wine I've had this week was the Pheasant's Tears Chinuri from Georgia, and these
haven't
wines,
had that one.
You haven't had it. It's really exciting, man. This guy was his name's John Wertman. He was an American who moved to the country of Georgia, just in the
I heard about this,
the Kakheti region in the foothills of the Caucasus Mountains, and he does very traditional style wines. This is a wine that's made in amphora there, Kvevri, but without the skins, and it is just like really pure, and it has like that great mineral grip to it, and it's exciting. And I've tasted a few vintages of their wines, and this is I think the best one they've done so far. So it was the Pheasant's Tears Chinuri 2013, and I had this at a Georgian wine seminar that was done by Lisa Granick, Master of Wine. That was really, really interesting.
Cool. That sounds great. Man, I don't know. I'm, you know, like yourself, we get to taste a lot of wine. So by the kind of looking back in the catalog, it's a little tough to recall, but a couple of nights ago, I had a bottle of 85 Henri Gouges, Le Saint-Georges, which was really cool, and a producer that I think the wines are much easier to understand with that sort of age on them, and which you don't get a lot of exposure to, but I'd had before in France, and I don't think I've had anything old, of that sort of level in since I was in France, and so it was cool to try that. It brought back a lot of memories, and it was really delicious.
There's always that thing where you have a wine in the country that it's from, and it just tastes better in a way. You know, like you're on vacation, you're like
on the Amalfi Coast, you're in Paris. There's all the beautiful things surrounding you. It's bound to taste better than in a white walled room. So
right. Did it deliver in the same way that you remembered?
Yeah, it was really great. That's awesome. It was really, really great. It's pretty classic, old school, old Burgundy, kind of bready, sort of funky, but elegant and youthful, alive and well. So
that's awesome. Cool stuff. I get that from guests all the time. They're like, I remember, I had this wine in Italy, in Tuscany. I was on my honeymoon, and it was so much better there than it is here. Like, do they add so many sulfites to when they ship it out? You're like, no, you're on your honeymoon.
Exactly. Like, you're just happier.
You're just happier.
They're like, the wine's the same thing, but you're just happier. That's funny. People, I have a client who did the same thing, but they were in Rome, and he bought like four cases of this Sagrantino. I can't even remember the name of the producer. He came back and he's like, I love this wine. He's like, I bought every vintage of it and blah, blah, blah. And then he brought a bottle in and we opened it and it's like terrible, horrible. And he's like, I swear that this was way better. And he's like, the guy was so cool. And you can just imagine the like Italian winemaker just selling it, right? Yeah. And this guy just scooped up a few cases of wine, brought it back, and now he's stuck with a bunch of funky tannic Sagrantino.
Yeah, and Sagrantino, so, like, that's
not... When it's bad, it's really bad, right?
Yeah, it is a rough tannic, rough wine. All right, so before working at Charlie Bird, you're at Frasca. I feel like we've had on quite a few people from Frasca. We've had Bobby, we've had Carlin Carr.
Oh, cool.
We've had... Did Dustin work at Frasca ever?
Dustin did, yeah. Wow. I didn't get the pleasure to work with him. I had, you know, started shortly after you left, but... Yeah.
Next
few guys for
gonna,
a small town restaurant.
We're gonna get the busser staff and the dishwashers from Frosker gonna be on the show next week.
Nice, yeah. Nice little bilingual Heritage Radio here.
obviously, you know, the Frosker is such an influential restaurant, yeah, for everyone in the industry. So it's no surprise that, you know, that someone who's as wonderful as you has worked there. How does that inform the way you have brought that experience to New York?
Yeah, I mean, Frosca really is, it's an incredible restaurant, right? You can drink incredibly well and you can learn a lot about wine there. And it, of course, has a just incredible wine program. but my, and kind of reflecting on my experience there, it's the work ethic, but also like the culture that they've built there. So a restaurant, you know, for those of you who don't know, it's in Boulder, Colorado. It's kind of off the very short, but small main drag, in Boulder, just kind of east, you know, in an area that's not like totally booming. And it's, you know, as Joe mentioned, just a really incredible restaurant with all this crazy acclaim. And what they've done is they harness people who may have not necessarily been totally dedicated to restaurants, and they instill this like sense of care and hospitality in everyone, even down to the dishwashers. And it's really, really incredible to go back there. You know, we just opened Charlie Bird and it's been super fun. Get to work with a lot of really great people. But a year in, you look at it and, you know, we've had some turnover and you've, you know, banged your head against the wall a little bit because people don't necessarily care about how the food was dropped or care about those things. And no, we're not trying to be a, you know, super formal restaurant, but the culture there that Bobby creates and that is like every single day kind of growing is really incredible and just inspiring, not only from a restaurant perspective, but I think for any business to have your staff like really care about what they do.
Yeah. And I'm sure that didn't happen overnight. That takes many, many years and people who've worked there for a super long time. So
for sure.
Don't be discouraged.
Though. No. A year in, we like, you know, a year and a half in at Charlie Bird. Now you kind of look back and, you know, there's a few really great people that, really do care and kind of take ownership. So
yeah. And Charlie Bird is just such an awesome restaurant. I remember when you guys opened the outdoor cafe, I jumped on that. That was super, super special. The wine list is, as I said at the top, the wine list is just awesome. One of the things I really love about it is how well edited it is. I think of a few other lists around town that there really aren't a lot where every single wine on that list you want to drink. And I imagine that is something that can be challenging for someone like you, who's been exposed to so many wines around the world. How do you focus on just the, you know, just the ones you want to have on the list at the time? And also talk kind of about your experience with Robert Bohr, who
is a
great, you know, one of the great wine guys around town as well.
For sure. Having a small wine list, I guess it feels like we put, and I do think we do, we put just as much energy into the small wine list as we would if we had, you know, a thick book of a wine list. But that was kind of Robert and Ryan's, you know, really original inspiration was they're two super talented guys who came from very formal backgrounds. Ryan being at the Little Nell, running that whole program, from the back house perspective, the chef, and then Robert, of course, just having the insane resume that he does, they both kind of looked at it and were like, we want to open up a restaurant that we would want to eat at, you know, not once a year for your anniversary, but every night kind of place, a really great neighborhood restaurant that was, you still had the option to drink well and to drink exciting wines without it being, you know, a huge kind of ceremony over wine service, but to do all the basics at the highest level and have, you know, a small curated selection of wines. So the wine list is like physically confined to really only 120 selections, which makes it super challenging when you get two bottles of something or, you know, one bottle of something. You can't really put it on the list because the next day it could, you know, very easily
you have
be.
To reprint. Yeah,
exactly.
Which you say only 120 bottles, and you know, thinking about the kind That's of true. Wines that you and Robert are exposed to and probably put on the list, like it, and the fact that it's a pretty, you know, it's a nice but a small restaurant. That's,
exactly.
That's an impressive amount of wines. Even
it is, that. Yeah, it is. I guess it, you know, people do say it's incredible. Even guests are like, "Wow, you have a big wine list." And I guess it's coming from a wine list which is now 4 pages, but the one before was, you know, 64 pages. And then, you know, Robert's background, of course, at Crew, where they had like
two
phone books of,
they had to bring it out on like a trolley, yeah. A cart, like all of like the wine list.
It's really, really incredible. So it, to that degree, it's minuscule, but you know, compared to other neighborhood restaurants, it is kind of lengthy. But I think the idea was just to do that, was, you know, instead of having, you know, kind of a vertical of certain wines, we're like, we're just going to have one vintage, and it'll be a vintage that we think is drinking great right now, and that's the one that you should have. Mm-hmm. Or instead of, you know, I love being able to go to, whether it's, you know, Daniel or La Tour de Jean in Paris or wherever it is, and you see these incredible, incredible lengthy verticals that you can kind of pick through and really geek out on the year and geek out on vineyards and stuff. But that's like, again, that's the same idea of, you know, that takes a little bit more effort. It's a little bit less time away from your experience with your guests and having fun and all of those things. So they really just wanted to kind of instill this idea of it being like, it's going to be great, but it's going to be quick, and it'll be kind of right there, easy for you to digest, no matter who you are, whether you're a sommelier or, mm-hmm. or someone just getting into wine or someone who doesn't really care about wine at all, so it doesn't overwhelm anyone.
Now, talking about vintages, you have a number of older vintages on the wine list.
Yeah.
You have some 1979 Il Colle Brunello.
It's delicious.
Something I actually think I might have served Bobby and Lachlan last time I saw them at Lartuzzi.
Oh, cool.
1985 Angelo Rocca Primitivo.
Yeah.
That's one I don't know.
It's a weird wine. It's
85 Primitivo.
It's so it spends, I believe it spent like, you know, between 7 and 9 years in wood. It's effectively Amarone, but from Puglia. It has some RS. It's kind of our, you know, we found it. We got a really good deal on it. It drinks like older Amarone. It's kind of, you know, more like secondary and mm-hmm. A lot of the kind of dried fruit character to it, but it has like the density and sweetness and power of those wines. And for, you know, 85, it's I think $125 on the list. It's kind of fun,
right? And that's like
it's hard to find for, yeah, it's kind of hard to find Amarone that's, you know, not like young port,
right,
for that kind of price,
right? So it's, yeah, it's hard to find Amarone that is
by no means am I an advocate for, you know, Amarone here, but it's a fun one that
that's cool. So is that something that you do more with cheese or some kind of meat that might have like a sweeter glaze on it or something,
yeah,
like that?
For sure. I think it's a good like last red, you know, because it's super impactful. I really think of, and that's one thing, like people where at Frasca or, you know, some other restaurants, it's like it's kind of easier to pair because maybe the whole table is having the same dish, mm-hmm. or at least having the same kind of course, whether it's like crudo and then into pasta and that kind of thing. And we have that, but like pairing can be really tricky there because it's a la carte and people share a bunch of stuff. And so we really try to encourage people to like, progress with wine. So start out with like a lean, sharp white, and then have something denser, have some red Burgundy, and then get into Sangiovese or Nebbiolo or Syrah, those kind of things to kind of work your way through. And then if you want, and you're really trying to get after it, you can, you know, cap the night with some Angelo Rocca Primitivo. If you got a little bit of a sweet tooth.
Yeah, I mean, but I get the feeling that, you know, the wines on the list are wines that you just, like, just truly, truly love. And it's exciting for me to go there and find find wines either, you know, it's a vintage that is not, hasn't been available in a long time, and the wine's in great condition, or it's just something I've, like, never heard. For me, not to say that I know everything about Italian wines, but I taste a ton of Italian wines all the time, and to find something that I've never even heard of is it's super exciting, and that's what keeps me coming back. It's just it's awesome. You guys do really, really good work with finding some of those older vintages and putting them on there.
Yeah, it's fun. It keeps it interesting.
And so, what's the move if a guest maybe wants to try something that's not on? It sounds like you guys might have a few things that aren't on the list that you get in short.
We do for sure. You know, it wasn't something that we want to, you know, make like a huge part of the restaurant, just because you don't, any time you put, and you know, truthfully, people kind of give us a little bit of feedback that, you know, in that short section of Southern Italian wines, it goes from, or, you know, from the northern, like, Friuli part of wine, it goes from, you know, a $50 bottle to a $275 bottle with only four selections. So it can look like your wine list is expensive, and that really, like, turns people off in a certain way, or makes them uncomfortable if you're, you know, like just trying to crush rosé on the patio, mm-hmm. or whatever. But we have, you know, friends and clients, and you're in New York, and there's such incredible access to older wines, and, you know, we're lucky, and we have the confidence that we can serve them well, and that we can sell them. So we do have, you know, not a massive selection, but we have like the Gouge, which isn't, you know, a crazy expensive bottle of wine, it's like whatever it was. But, you know, we have some things that we kind of hand sell, and Robert just wrote up this really beautiful handwritten cellar book that has some of our favorite producers with maybe, you know, a couple of extra years of age on them, or simply stuff that we only have one bottle of. Mm-hmm. So we want to kind of dedicate it to our friends and kind of, yeah.
So come in,
manage that. Exactly.
Do the right
have a
thing.
Conversation and we can style you out. It's kind of the right thing.
All right. With that, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more of Grant Reynolds, wine director of Charlie Bird, here on In the Drink.
Cool.
That was awesome.
Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small, from careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels, to lower barrel entry proof before heat cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. And no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's Cost Be Damned Taste Is Everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said, it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's, phenomenal. For more information, visit michters.com or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
And we're back on In the Drink. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, here with Grant Reynolds, wine director from the great wine destination and food destination, Charlie Bird, a great restaurant, very close to, kind of close to Lartuzzi, a few blocks away on 6th Avenue.
That's true.
Grant, so something I love about your program as well is that you do a half bottle, a pretty extensive half bottle selection, whereas you're not listing half bottles, but anything that is on the wine list, a guest can order a half bottle of. Is that an accurate characterization of
it? It is amazing. Totally. So we have a little plug on the last page of the wine list to our friend John Slover, who really helped us out a lot, kind of getting the restaurant off the ground, but also who at a couple of places around the city did, at Chiano, I guess more recently, did the half bottle program. So where he'll open up, and you know, where we now open up any wine on the wine list aside from sparkling wine as a half of a full bottle, essentially. We don't have, they're not like 375s, but it's half of a 750 or even half of a Magnum. In certain cases, we'll, you know, do that too.
So if the bottle costs $100, it's
$50.
$50.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Don't you get a ton of waste? I mean, what if, you know, you have 10 different tables all get a half bottle and you have 10 wines open at the end of the night?
Yeah. I mean, we try to, you know, that's the thing, is a lot of the wines are sold by us. And so, you know, hopefully you can, and I don't see anything, you know, wrong with this. You kind of steer people into things that are open. But also what we do is, you know, we have a very short wine by the glass selection and program for that matter. And that's intentional because we often have wines open. You know, we don't have a Chardonnay by the glass, but chances are we're going to have some white Burgundy open by the half bottle that we can, suggest to people and sell just a glass of, exactly, that second half of. So
I think this is amazing on so many levels. I mean, it's so on the side of the diners. They have, you know, you make your 120 bottle selection list, all of a sudden it's 240 in a way, because if they're not in the mood to drink a whole bottle, now they can have just a half bottle. And it also just really encourages the conversation between the guest and the sommelier or the wine director or server or whoever it is. I love it on so many levels, and you feel like you're on the inside too. you hear, you know, we do have a glass of Burgundy that would go really well with that we have open.
Exactly.
Like, oh, yeah. That's,
people love that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it is really cool, you know, because when people order, and this is real, like they'll have, you know, flute crudo and razor clams to start, and then their pasta is going to be like rigatoni with lamb ragu, and then they're going to end with chicken. It's like there isn't, in any part of the world, there's no perfect wine for all of that food, right? But you can, you know, crush a half bottle of Chablis and then figure out, you know, a bottle of red that'll kind of accompany those two courses well. So it really opens up and also, you know, ultimately, just as you said, it kind of makes things a little bit more interesting for myself and also for guests within that. So it's fun.
So you have a shameless plug section where you carry wine made by other sommeliers in the industry. Why do you think that there's a movement of sommeliers towards producing their own wine? Is it something you ever want to do yourself? Tell us about that.
I don't know if, you know, if... I don't have any plans to right now. I worked Harvest in Burgundy at Dujac, and it was super, super fun. I learned a lot. I, you know, was like picking grapes, which was very, very, very humbling and hard work, but a cool experience too. And then, you know, we get to visit a lot of wineries, and so you kind of see winemaking from that side of things. But the idea behind that was, I totally thought when Robert like first kind of suggested that and brought up that idea, I was like, you're crazy. You know, people are going to kind of like give us a little bit of, you know, grief on it or whatever, but people think it's super fun, and it's true. They are friends. They're, you know, people that we have really great relationships with and are great people, and the wines are pretty tasty. So why wouldn't we support them? Yeah. Just like we would support our winemaker friends, we're supporting our sommelier friends who are involved in wine projects to different degrees. So it's been fun. And Yeah, we're shameless about it because, frankly, we would have had the wines on the wine list regardless, you know, so.
Might as well be open.
Might as well, yeah, call yourself out.
I
love it.
I mean, you know, Bobby and Lachlan's wine, the Scarpetta wine, is one of our most popular.
Yeah, it's delicious.
Guys, stop selling the Scarpetta Barbera because it's just like, it's like a go-to for so many people at our restaurants. And I love the Timido by them, the sparkling rosé.
Yeah, that's the one that we have right now. It's tasty. It's easy, great valued, sparkling rosé that people can throw back. So it's fun.
Harvest at Dujac? That's awesome.
Yeah, that was really cool.
And what did you learn from that, other than that picking grapes is hard work?
Oh, man. Well, Jeremy Sass, the winemaker at Dujac and the son of Jacques of the second half of the word Dujac, he's such a smart guy about Italian wine, about German wine, about everything. He's just a really, really incredible person. So aside from learning, and getting like a real insider's look at Burgundy, we got to drink. That's where I had, for the first time, Old Gouge, and that's where you have Old Griot Hermitage, not to totally blow up and expose all the incredible wine that Jeremy has in his cellar, but you, in like a 4-week period, I had wines that I only really ever dreamt of and got exposure to, which had never left where they were bottled effectively. So that's a really cool experience. And, just to see how much is on the line as far as winemaking goes really gives you, really gave me, a lot of appreciation, even more so for what we do and for winemakers in general and how it's farming. Mm-hmm. It was 2012. It was kind of a rainy harvest. It was cold. People were out there grinding it out, working super hard in, not comfortable conditions, but you worked all year to kind of clean up and pick grapes and get things going at that time of year. And there was just a really incredible energy around that. And, of course, we could talk about all the technical stuff that I learned and all of those things that you can kind of geek out on. But harvest is an incredible thing. These guys work all year long to really, really work hard for a week in Burgundy. And it's all kind of on the line there. And thankfully, the wines, I think, are really great. I've had them out of barrel now, and they should be arriving anytime. Well, 2012 Burgundy is slowly arriving into New York now, so that's kind of cool. You can think about what it was like when you were there and all those things. So
do you feel like this gives you a deeper kind of understanding?
For sure. Yeah.
Is this something you want to do again? Do you want to go?
I would love to. You really can understand, you see everything from, you're walking around the vineyards and it's like a super extended wine visit. That's like drawn out and incredibly detail oriented, and you get to meet everybody and pick a lot of different people's brains about stuff. And I would love to do it again. I think it gives you incredible insight into a region, into the culture there, and
it's true,
and also the specifics of winemaking. So
many wine visits, you go and visit the cellar and the tasting room, and unless you're in Georgia, at some very traditional winery where they just have a couple amphora on the ground, pretty much most cellars look pretty similar. They have stainless steel, or they have small barrels, or they have big barrels, and then some old places have cement, and they really look all the same. In the tasting room, you could taste those wines anywhere.
Yeah.
But it's the vineyard that makes wineries so unique and makes wine so exciting. And it's to get to spend that much time in a great vineyard had to be just a super special experience.
Yeah, it was super special. Picking grapes in Clos de la Roche is not an easy thing. It's steep and rocky and you're kind of aggravated, but you really get to kind of feel it. And it's super fun.
I know you spent some time in Piedmont as well.
I did, yeah. Kind of early on, I somehow figured out, I guess I was 21, I had just turned 21, how to take a semester off from CU Boulder and kind of guided by Bobby to go to Piedmont, and I got a little bit of cash from the university to write about traditional winemaking as you know, whatever, I forget, as an independent study in Barolo versus like modern stuff, because that was kind of, you know, something that was, that conversation happens less now, but you know, 5 years ago that was a big part of the conversation. So and it really grabbed me, so I got to go do that and visit a bunch of people, and it was way over my head, you know, being a 21-year-old kid visiting Roberto Quinterno by himself. It was like, you know, only by, you know, and sort of beneath Bobby could I have ever made that happen. But that was a really cool experience. I got to spend a couple months there. So
that, I mean, I'm just so impressed. That's brilliant that you're able to convince your college to give you money to, you know, drink wine.
Yeah, no, it was cool. Everything, I put up a lot of my own cash. Not if anybody from CU is listening here, but it was a really great experience, and that opened up a lot of doors for me moving forward. Having lived in Italy a little bit before when I was younger, it was a really easy place for me to kind of get my roots and really learn about wine as fast as possible.
So what's your take on the current state of that conversation of the traditional versus modern Barolo producers?
Yeah, I think it's changed a lot, you know, and the thing about Barolo is, right, we're just tasting 2010. So what happened over the last 4 years, a lot can change for a producer, you know, as far as winemaking goes. And what I think you see now is you see producers like, I guess, like Vietti or like, you know, Giuseppe Vaira, who are, I wouldn't call them, they're not like staunch traditionalists, right? They're not making, you know, they make a lot of wine. They make a lot of really great wine. They make wine which is kind of softer and fruity and aromatic and really, really delicious and appealing in its youth. And, you know, as we've also seen, is incredibly long lived, but they're not, I don't think that's a modern thing to do, but maybe they're using a little bit more new oak in certain cuvées, or they're doing, you know, certain things in the winery. So that kind of, for whatever reason, takes them out of the traditional camp. But I think you see that kind of gray area now. There's a lot of really good wine that's kind of made from producers who you're like, are they traditional? Are they modern? You know, it really, I think it's hard. And I also don't think it's fair, because maybe one producer might make a couple of different wines, and they might make them in a couple of different styles, or for whatever reason, that wine is drinking a little bit flashier that year than that. You know, I think it's hard to really, there are the great traditional houses of Barolo and Barbaresco, for that matter, and there's a lot of great innovators too, but I think, you know, that kind of area of traditional and modern is it's a little more gray now than maybe what it was in the mid-90s, where everybody was like barrique and rotofermenters and that sort of stuff. People are thankfully, I think, kind of moving away from that. But
the overlap in the Venn diagram that is traditional versus modern is getting larger.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
There's less. Less. The traditionalists are using some of the more modern techniques, and the modernists are scaling back some of the oak and some of the ripeness.
Yeah. Exactly.
And I don't know if you saw the movie about the Barolo boys that was just screened.
I haven't yet.
There's some really great footage, and there's footage of Giuseppe Rinaldi, arguably the, you know, if not the greatest, one of the greatest of the more traditional camp. And he says in the movie, there's a clip of him saying that Barolo should be it should be like angry and hard when it's young, and it should not be delightful to drink when it's young.
I agree with that in a lot of ways, but you take a vintage like, you know what, 2008 and 2009 Rinaldi, those wines are delicious right now.
They're delicious. I'll drink that.
They're, you know, it's, yeah, they're fruitier, 09 especially, you know, whatever it is. But I know people ask me this, it's like, well, isn't that too young? Like, yeah, the wine has a lot of life ahead of it. But I think it's really great and really giving right now too. You know, there's, I wish I could drink 85, 89 Rinaldi all the time, but I can't. And so, you know, to have 08 and 09, you're kind of counting your blessings too. And yeah, I put some of those wines away, but they're pretty tasty now too. And they are tannic. They do need food, but that's the nature of the grape. Because even when they're 20 years old, they're still tannic and they still need food. And mm-hmm. that's kind of a beautiful thing.
So. I agree. All right, Grant, I think that's all the time we have
all right.
we have today.
Thank you so much. This is fun.
I definitely encourage all of you, if you haven't been yet, to check out Charlie Bird. Not only is the wine list amazing, as I've said several times, the food is really delicious, but it's, you get this kind of warm, sweet hospitality that just makes it a very comfortable and lovely place. And I'll head it up by our man here, Grant Reynolds. So thank you, man. I really appreciate it. And thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.